Welcome to Sunstone 2010 Salt Lake City Symposium. This is session 354, Joseph Smith's Personal Polygamy. I remind all of you to speak into the mic. That will include you when you have questions during the question and answer period at that mic. And it includes the two presenters at this mic. You should have your lips about as close as mine are. That's because these mics are designed to pick up close sound but not ambient sound in the room. I'd like to ask you to silence your cell phones and other noisemakers right now, including your watches that beep on the hour. That's because it's really irritating when someone gets up and their cell phone is going, and you have to listen to it all the way back in the room and out the door, because they're not going to answer in the meeting, because that would be rude. When you're engaged in discussing a topic like this, there are bound to be questions. We will have a 35-minute presentation from Brian Hales and a 10 to 12 minute response from George Smith, and then time for you to question and them to answer. Brian Hales' biographical information is fairly extensive. He graduated from Utah State in 1981 with a BS degree, graduated from the University of Utah School of Medicine in 1985 as an MD. He is active staff at the Davis Hospital and Medical Center. He is active staff at Davis Surgical Center. And he is active staff as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Brian?
I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I have people ask me, why, Brian, are you so interested in plural marriage? And then I have others who ask me, Brian, why are you so interested? And to the latter group, I just observe that I can't even monog very well, so don't worry about me polygy. I was very excited when I heard that George was going to be the respondent. For a couple of reasons, I figured I've been presenting at Sunstone every year for a long time, and I think it was just 2 years ago. I think we had five people when we began, and I wanted to piggyback on the fact that most people know who George is, and with all the things that he's been doing for many years in Mormon history and similar themes. So glad to have him here. I'm also glad to have his response, because I'm coming out with some books, and he and I see this topic very differently, and so this will be good for you and also be good for me. I do want to warn you, though, that he hasn't had a paper to respond to. I work from the PowerPoint project, and so he really doesn't know the things that I'm saying in between the slides. He knows the themes that I'll hit upon, and so it puts him at a bit of a disadvantage, which I apologize for, but this is usually how I present these things. The real reason that I'm interested in plural marriage has to do with a member of my family who was excommunicated from the church for joining a polygamy group back in 1989. 3 years later, I wrote this book, and I tell people that my books are part of my full anesthesia services, and if ever that were true, this would be an example. Max Anderson helped with it, but I did most of the writing. And then later on, I've done a couple of other books that deal with polygamy, but most of the questions, or at least over half, had to do not with Mormon fundamentalist polygamy, but with Joseph Smith's polygamy. I didn't know the answers. And so, I have a website also that you can go to. But I jumped back into the research mode and got with Don Bradley, who did logged over 1,500 hours just going around trying to find every document that we could identify that dealt with this topic. And he'd get me either a transcript or a copy. And those are going to be coming out in two volumes early next year. We've already started editing volume two. And I've tried in these to either quote or at least reference every known document that deals with Joseph Smith's polygamy. I also have a website that I uploaded a couple of months ago. It's josephsmithspolygamy.com. and I'll be referring to it a number of times. It's something I did all by myself, so it's a little homegrown, but there's some really good things there. It's an apologetic site. Unlike the books, they won't be apologetic, but the site is. But there's some good research tools and things for people that are looking at Joseph Smith's polygamy. One thing that I worry about as I've been trying to read all these documents dealing with Joseph Smith's polygamy is that sometimes sensationalized claims that are primarily from anti-Mormon writers have essentially shaped our opinions of Joseph Smith's polygamy. One example is that in 1842, apostate John C. Bennett referred to Joseph Smith as an unprincipled libertine, unequaled in the history of civilized man. And if we look closely, I believe there is significant evidence that John C. Bennett was not a polygamy insider, and that he never once discussed eternal or plural marriage with Joseph Smith. And I know George and I differ on this, but and maybe in the question and answer we can go through some of that evidence. I think anybody who wants to quote Bennett as a polygamy insider needs to provide some credible evidence that he in fact was. You're not supposed to be able to read this slide, but what we have on the left-hand side is a year, the next column is a name of a person, and then there's a quotation. It's an accusation against Joseph Smith or the Mormons of sexual impropriety of some sort. And then the last column is just for references. And I've seen hundreds and hundreds of these types of narratives and accounts, and you can go to the website and read them all. They're actually all there, and you can, and they're not this small, so you can see them. But also, as I've been going through all of these accounts, I've identified 53 allegations of sexual impropriety leveled at Joseph Smith by 26 different accusers. And this is primarily the evidence used by the naturalists to say that Joseph was empowered by libido. He just wanted sex. That's why he did all his polygamy stuff. And yet, if you go to the website, you can look at each of the 53 allegations, and I've quoted them right there. They're exactly as they appear in the primary documents. I've pulled no punches. There's no editing. And you can decide for yourself. I'm nonplussed by any of them, okay? But if you want to disagree with me, that's just fine. But the big concern that I have is that they have shaped how Joseph Smith practiced his own personal polygamy. And when Joseph started polygamy, he was also giving an example to the other 85 women and 29 men who joined him in polygamy before his death. And so we're going to look at seven or eight observations, some of which will probably be new to you, about how he personally practiced plural marriage. The first of those is that I believe Joseph Smith recognized that plural marriage was difficult. Polygamy on earth expands the man's emotional and sexual relationships as a husband, as it simultaneously fractionates the woman's emotional and sexual relationship as a wife. I don't think you can defend polygamy as being fair. I think it's very sexist and very unfair here on this earth. And I also think that Joseph Smith recognized this. Bathsheba B. Smith remembered that, "I heard the prophet give instructions concerning plural marriage. He counseled the sisters not to trouble themselves in consequence of it, that all would be right and the result would be for their glory and exaltation." Joseph also gave at least a couple of his wives encouragement to get their own witness, okay, not to believe him, but to get their own witness from heaven. Mary Elizabeth Rollins said, "I did not believe. If God told him so, why could he not come and tell me? The angel told him I should have a witness. An angel came to me, it went through me like lightning." Another of Joseph Smith's wives, Lucy Walker, wrote this. She said, "I felt highly insulted, and he said that if I wanted to know whether the principle was true, I could go to God and find out. Finally, as I was praying the last time, an angel of the Lord appeared to me and told me that the principle was of God and for me to accept it." A second characteristic of Joseph Smith's polygamy is that he did not marry every woman that he could. Some writers kind of portray him as frantically going about Nauvoo, trying to marry and get into bed with every woman that he could. Benjamin F. Johnson wrote, "The orphan girl, Marianne Hale, that my mother had raised from a child, was now living with us. And I asked Joseph Smith if he would not like her." Joseph, and by the way, we're indebted to George for publishing this book, William Clayton's Journal. And thank you, seriously. Joseph Smith said, "No, but she's for you. You keep her and take her for your wife, and you will be blessed." Another example with Lucy Walker, she and her older sister lived with the prophet in his home, and Lucy testified in 1892 that Catherine, who had been there longer than Lucy, was never married to Joseph and knew nothing about her own sealing to the prophet. There are two narratives that are very popular. One has to do with John Taylor, the other with Heber C. Kimball, of Joseph Smith going in and demanding to marry their wives. And there's actually very good evidence that Joseph used polygamy to test the devotion and convictions of primarily the apostles, and perhaps William Law, but included were not only these two, but Party P. Pratt, Orson Pratt, Brigham Young, Orson Hyde, maybe even William Smith. But these but what we find is that he didn't marry any of these women. There's no historical evidence showing that Joseph Smith demanded a follower give up his wife, and then he went off and married her. And then in two cases, rather than seeking a woman for his own plural wife, Joseph Smith acted as an intermediary, trying to set up a plural marriage for one of his brothers. One was Hiram and one was William. And the account of the one with Hiram that never did take place was with a woman, Almira Knight, the daughter of Martha McBride Knight. And this is what she remembered later. This is a late account, but it's kind of entertaining. She says, "One day, Mother and I were in the front room, and Joseph Smith came walking down the street." This is Nauvoo. "And turned in at our gate. I had a hunch. And as he entered the front door, I went out the back, and I remained until he left." A third characteristic is that I believe Joseph exercised patience when teaching potential new plural wives. Emily Partridge related, this is kind of a long account, it comes from the Temple Lot transcripts from 1892, but she said, "Joseph asked me if I could keep a secret. It run along for a good while. He said to me he had intended to tell me something, but he had no opportunity to do so, and so he would write me a letter if I would agree to burn it as soon as I read it, and with that I looked frightened. So I told him that I would rather that he would not write to me, and then he asked me if I wanted him to say any more, and I said yes, that I did not want to hear anything more about it at all, for I had gotten a little frightened about it." She knew what it was. Well, it went on in that condition, and there was not anything more said about it for several months, not until 1843, for he had no other opportunity until then, and I did not think he would ever say anything more about it until then. "But I had thought a great deal about it in that time and prayed to be enlightened in regard to what I should have done. Well, in that time I became convinced that there was nothing wrong about it, but there was nothing more said for a good while after I came to that conclusion. I think it was months before there was anything more said about it, but I don't know just how long it was. But he spoke to me again and wanted an opportunity to speak to me, and I granted it. He told me then what he wanted to say to me, and he taught me this principle of plural marriage called polygamy now, but we called it celestial marriage. And he told me that this principle had been revealed to him, but it was not generally known." And then on her wedding day, and this is a different source, but she wrote, "I cannot tell all that Joseph said. I was married then and there. Joseph went home his way, and I going home my way, and I going my way alone. A strange way of getting married, wasn't it?" So they didn't even spend their wedding night together. Another example is Almira Johnson. She related that Joseph Smith first spoke to me on the subject at the house of my brother Benjamin F. Johnson. "And I also lived a portion of the time at Brother Joseph's in Nauvoo, and many conversations passed between him and myself on this subject." Now, when it comes to teaching about plural marriage patiently, the most commonly quoted document is this right here. And Lucy Walker quotes Joseph Smith saying this to Lucy: "I have no flattering words to offer. It is a command of God to you. I will give you until tomorrow to decide this matter. If you reject this message, the gate will be closed forever against you." Very popular with antagonists, because you got Joseph with a 24-hour time limit, an ultimatum, and the implication is he's so excited to get into bed with Lucy Walker that he is pushing her with everything he can to make this happen. Now, what we usually don't hear is the rest of the story. Now, I'm old enough to remember Paul Harvey, but there are some details that need to put this into context. First off, Lucy Walker also wrote that it was in the year 1842 that President Joseph Smith sought an interview with me, and he said, "I have a message for you. I have been commanded of God to take another wife, and you are the woman." My astonishment knew no bounds. This announcement was indeed a thunderbolt to me. He asked me if I believed him to be a prophet of God. "Most assuredly I do," I replied. He fully explained to me the principle of plural or celestial marriage. And then, and these are the details that don't usually come out, she agonized between 4 and 16 months. You see, the ultimatum came April 30th of 1843, But it was introduced to her in 1842, so there, it's at least 4 months, probably not 16, but somewhere in that. And the prophet just waited for her. And then she wrote, "I was tempted and tortured beyond endurance until life was not desirable. Oh, that the grave would kindly receive me, that I might find rest. Oh, let this bitter cup pass. And thus I prayed in the agony of my soul. The prophet discerned my sorrow. He saw how unhappy I was." You see, only after waiting many months, we don't know how many, and then seeing Lucy's agony, did Joseph Smith give her a 24-hour time limit and an ultimatum, and he also promised her that she could receive her own witness. Lucy related that that night, "My room was lighted up by heavenly influence like that, like the brilliant sun bursting through the darkest cloud. My soul was filled with calm." A fourth characteristic of Joseph Smith's polygamy is that when he was rejected by women, they respected. When women rejected him, he respected their decisions. And sometimes he's misrepresented on this topic as well. Lucy Walker remembered the prophet's teaching that a woman would have her own choice. This was not a privilege that could. This was a privilege that could not be denied her. And we have in the literature at least five women who rejected Joseph Smith's plural marriage proposals. And this isn't new stuff. I think Compton has these, and they're out there. But it's Esther Johnson, Lydia Moon, Sarah Granger Kimball, Cordelia Morley, and Rachel Ivins. And the reason we know about these accounts is not from anything that happened publicly in Nauvoo. Four of the five come from private records that are years or decades after Nauvoo. And then there's William Clayton's journal again that we're also indebted to. But the point is that they rejected Joseph as plural wives, and nobody found out about it. Everybody just moved on. Okay, very quietly, nothing happened. There are two exceptions, though. Sarah Pratt, she made very sensationalized accusations against Joseph Smith. It's very plain Sarah and John Bennett are having a sexual relationship. Contrary to what some historians have written, the evidence is very good. And she's trying to cover this up. Nancy Rigdon made some accusations privately, and then the people around her are the ones that advertised this and brought it out into the public. And in both cases, Joseph Smith defended himself against the claims that were being made. But to say that any woman who rejected Joseph, that he was going to destroy their reputation or something like that, certainly is not borne out by the five women that we see here. And there's every reason to believe that if Nancy and Sarah would have not taken their cases public, that they too would have, it would have come and gone without there being any of the problems that did occur. A fifth characteristic of Joseph Smith's polygamy is that he allowed for at least one of his plural wives to divorce him. It's kind of a new thing. We're indebted to the Andrew Jensen papers and a few other things for this. And here's the timeline. The woman is Flora Ann Woodworth. And in August of 1843, Emma Smith is on the warpath. Seriously. And she's finding out about the marriages of Joseph Smith, and she's not liking it. There's a confrontation between Flora Ann and Emma on the 22nd. The very next day, Flora Ann legally marries Carlos Gove, a non-member. And then we find Joseph meeting with Flora Ann and with her mother on the 26th and two more visits. Some historians have suggested these are actually for sexual rendezvous. I doubt that would be likely with a legal husband there introduced on the 23rd. But what we have is Melissa Law, one of Joseph's plural wives, recalled in 1887, Flora Ann Woodworth married Carlos Gove at Nauvoo with the consent of the prophet. And I don't believe that was given prospectively. I think it was retrospectively, I'm guessing. And this is speculation here. Feel free to conjecture to your heart's desire. But I really think that during those other visits that were recorded in Clayton's journal, that he's taking care of this issue. And we don't know whether Flora Ann remained sealed to him for the next life or not. She was not one of the 29 who was sealed in the Nauvoo Temple for eternity by proxy to Joseph. Andrew Jensen also recorded that Flora Ann regretted her last marriage, her husband being an unbeliever and intended to cling to the prophet. I think Jensen may have been talking to Emily Partridge. She used the term cling and used it in the context of an eternal sealing. A sixth characteristic of Joseph Smith's polygamy is that he provided for the material needs of his plural wives directly or indirectly, usually indirectly, but they all... We don't have any complaints from the 34 wives, and the number 34 is Compton's 33 plus Esther Dutcher, who Michael Marquardt actually discovered and made me aware of. But we, looking at the writings from these 34 individuals, we find no complaints from any of them saying Joseph abused them in any way, sexually, or that, that he left them desolate, nothing like that from any of these women. And oftentimes he would just find a family for the woman to live with, but they all were taken care of, as near as I can tell with the research that we have. Now, I want to spend just a minute talking about these 34 women. Why in the world would Joseph Smith marry 34 wives? Todd Compton asked a question, you know, if the angel's commanding it. And he did relate, Joseph Smith, that an angel with a sword commanded him to. And I have an article coming out in Mormon Historical Studies, coming out in, I think, the next issue, where I've identified 20 accounts that talk about the angel and the sword from 9 different individuals who knew Joseph Smith. So if you're interested in that, Mormon Historical Studies, next issue. But he felt like he was commanded to do it. But you would think that maybe just marrying a handful would be enough, but Joseph went on being sealed. One possible reason is libido, to expand sexual license. And this is really the only way almost people today can interpret Joseph Smith's behavior. If we go out on the street with a microphone and interview 100 people and tell them, Joseph Smith established polygamy among the Mormons, why do you think he did it? And the answer would be from 99 of the 100, well, Joseph wanted sex. And the one who doesn't say that probably doesn't know what polygamy means, okay? In a sexually saturated society, at such a telestial level, that's the only way, essentially, that we can interpret Joseph's behavior, at least on average. I really like this quote from Richard L. Bushman. He said, polygamy is an interesting thing because it serves as a Rorschach test. People project onto Joseph Smith and polygamists their own sense about human nature. And in fact, there is evidence of sexual relations. If you'll go to my website, I've documented it with 9 of his plural wives with some ambiguous evidence for 5 more. And so it definitely was present in some of the marriages. However, and I put this slide in just for George because I know he and I disagree on maybe all 4 of these. I don't know if he'll respond to that, but it gave him something else to talk about if he happened to agree with these other things. But I believe that the evidence of sexual relations is lacking or unpersuasive in 4 groups. Women to whom Joseph was not married, and I believe he was married to Fanny Alger. The second is women sealed for the next life only, that is, eternity-only sealings. And we do have a very good example of at least one. And then sealings to 2 14-year-old wives. And I would argue anybody who says Joseph is sleeping with a 14-year-old is going beyond the evidence. And then lastly, in sexual polyandrous situations, and we're just in the early rounds on that one, I'm sure there will be lots more opportunities to discuss whether Joseph Smith did practice sexual polyandry, but I will assert that he did not. And you'll just have to wait for my books or for my next Sunstone presentation or something to get the rest of the details there. I also argue that sexual relations were really not that common. We have good evidence for 2 offspring for Joseph, one Josephine Fisher, a second one, a child, Olive Frost. They both died before they got out of Nauvoo. But if you go to my website, I've also documented 17 more individuals who are supposed to be Joseph's offspring. And there's analysis there. I don't think any of them are real. You can go there, though. I've tried to collect every name that anybody's ever mentioned in any setting. But I believe that we do have good evidence for 2, and the reference is perhaps to a 3rd. And that fact indicates that Joseph is not having a lot of sex because most of the women that he was married to were fertile, they could conceive. Joseph had 9 children with Emma, despite the fact that they were not together a lot. He was very virile, and I believe that this is indication that there was not a lot of sex there, but it is a bit conjectural. The second possible reason Joseph may have been married to 34 women was that he was physically attracted to them. And quite honestly, when you take John Bennett out of and his quotes out of the mix, I have found no evidence of any kind of courting behavior in Joseph Smith's plural wives and as he's looking for plural wives. But if there had been some, it wouldn't actually have surprised me a little bit, depending upon what it was. Because in his world, you know, polygamy was acceptable. It was a privilege, and he had the power, and it was from God, and so he was willing to do this. This feeling actually didn't seem to kick into the last part of 1842, but was there throughout the first 8 months of 43. Lucy Walker remembered that Joseph Smith often referred to the feelings that should exist between husbands and wives, and that his wives should be his bosom companions, the nearest and dearest objects on earth in every sense of the word. He said, men must beware how they treat their wives. A third reason is because more wives brings greater exaltation. This is a an idea that a number of people have promoted. One historian said each new woman brought into an eternal union increased not only the potential size of the family kingdom, but the man's exaltation as well. And then we have the fundamentalists that teach, Lauren Woolley taught in 1932, that to be the head of a dispensation, seven wives are necessary. To be the head of a patriarchal order, must have five wives. To be a president of the church, three wives are necessary. It's difficult for them to explain why Lauren Woolley was a monogamist his entire life, except for the last 2 years, and his father was only a polygamist for 8 years, John Woolley being their primary prophet outside of the church. The anti-Mormons get in on this. Richard A. Bain said the more wives acquired in this life, the better it will be in the next life. The most commonly quoted support for this, I think, is Benjamin Johnson, who wrote in 1903, "The prophet taught us that dominion and power in the great future would be commensurate with the number of wives and children and friends that we inherit here, and that our great mission to earth was to organize a nuclei of heaven to take with us, to the increase of which there would be no end." And the wording is a little ambiguous, but this is quoted a lot to support that more wives, more children, more adopted offspring, and you've got it made in the next life. So what we have are church members, anti-Mormons, historians, Mormon fundamentalists that are preaching this idea. But what I can't find is that the idea that more wives equals greater exaltation being taught by Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, or John Taylor, anybody really in any form of an authoritative position. The quote closest I can find for Joseph Smith is this quote from George A. Smith. He's writing to Joseph Smith III in 1869, and he said, "At one of the first interviews after returning from England with Joseph Smith, I was greatly astonished at hearing from his lips that the doctrine of patriarchal marriage, which he continued to preach to me from time to time, in his last conversation he administered a little chastisement to me for not stepping forward as he had indicated in patriarchal marriage. He assured me that the man who has many virtuous wives has many great prizes, though he admitted that the man who has one virtuous wife had one great prize, and said to me, you should not be behind in your privileges." And so you can argue that more prizes is better than less prizes. But we don't find any church leader saying, go out and marry as many as you can, or that a man with five wives has a greater exaltation than a man with three wives. There's nothing there that I can find. Maybe George has some quotes and we can hear those. And if you have something, feel free to let me know. But I think this is the policy, actually, in 1859, when asked how general is polygamy among you, President Brigham Young responded, "I could not say. Some of those present, the heads of the church, have each but one wife. Others have more. Each determines what is his individual duty." They were told they needed to practice polygamy, and that was satisfied with one wife. And then if they had more, that was something that they decided. A fourth possible reason is to create a dynastic connection, and some people have written a great deal about dynasticism. And so I went through and made a chart, and it's true that some of the women had brothers or fathers that were close friends or close to Joseph. The problem I have with this whole notion is that I can't find any theology to support it. I can't find anything that says if my daughter marries the church president that I am advantaged in eternity in some way. The other problem with it is that portraying the prophet as marrying women in order to create dynastic connections thrusts the women into the roles of pawns and a religious chess game played by Joseph and the women's male relatives, and I think Joseph would have called that unrighteous dominion. So this would be stronger if we could find some theology to support it. A fifth reason is to serve as a proxy husband. You've all heard these things. Henry Caswell, an anti-Mormon, wrote, "Many English and American women whose husbands and fathers have been sent by the prophet on distant missions were induced to become his spiritual wives, believing it to be the will of God." And actually, if you look at the 13 polyandrous husbands, 10 were not on missions at the time Joseph was sealed to their legal wives. Of the three possible exceptions, only one, Orson Hyde, is documented as serving as a missionary at the time, and he left for Jerusalem a year and a half prior. The other two women, we don't have marriage dates, so we don't know how to compare them to their husbands being on missions. The sixth possible reason is to fulfill premortal promises. Most of us have probably seen the musical Saturday's Warrior, and you remember when Todd sings the "I've seen that smile somewhere before," and then Julie responds and all of this, and it's kind of become Orthodox church teachings now. We actually only find this in one of the 34 marriages. Mary Elizabeth Rollins wrote that I was created for him before the foundation of the earth was laid. I had been dreaming for a number of years. I was his wife. But that's only one, a factor, as far as I can tell, in one. Maybe George will have some other insights here. A seventh possible reason is that women sought to be sealed to him. Again, this is not something that's seriously considered by most of the people writing about Joseph Smith's polygamy. They always want Joseph to be the one frantically going about trying to find women to marry. And I'm sorry, this is kind of small. This is a transcription from the Andrew Jensen papers, and it has to do with his plural, Joseph Smith's plural wife, Ruth Voth Sayers. Her husband, Edward Sayers, was not a member of the church, but Joseph hid out there while staying away from lawmen for a week or so. But Andrew Jensen, who actually was not a church historian at the time, he was an independent researcher, but he wrote this. He said, While there, the strongest affection sprang up between the prophet Joseph Smith and Mr. Sayers. The latter, not attaching much importance to the theory of a future life, insisted that his wife Ruth should be sealed to the prophet for eternity, as he himself should only claim her in this life. She was accordingly sealed to the prophet in Emma's presence, and thus became numbered among the prophet's plural wives. She continued to live with Mr. Sayers until his death. And there's three important points here. One, she went to Joseph. Second, that it was for eternity, according to the language used here. And then thirdly, Emma was present. Now, we don't know if she was pushing this forward or just there reluctantly, you know, frowning. But it was an eternity-only sealing, which might not have been threatening to her at all. And the reason this is kind of important is that people have portrayed Joseph as marrying, for example, Sarah Cleveland, one of Emma's counselors in the Relief Society presidency, and they usually imply that this was done underhanded, clandestine, behind Emma's back. And yet I argue that this was an eternity-only sealing exactly like this. We don't have evidence, so I'm conjecture. It's conjecture, speculation. But it, very easily, Emma could have said to Sarah, you can't be sealed to your non-member husband, so why don't you come be sealed for eternity to mine? Okay, and that one scenario is just never entertained by any of the writers that I've read. So looking back, libido, everybody's going to call it that. It's, you know, that's just where we live, unfortunately. Physical attraction could be an issue because more wives brings greater exaltation. Haven't found theology to support that, to create dynastic connections. Still can't find theology. Serve as a proxy husband. Don't think so. Fulfill premortal promises. One example, because women sought to be sealed to him. We have one example. I believe there are many more, but again, we just don't have the details we would like. Now, the last thing to talk about, and I hope my time is okay. All right, we're going to zoom here. I believe that Emma gave Joseph an ultimatum. Here's the timeline. Emma participates in four sealings in 1843 in May. The night after Emma gave Emily Partridge to Joseph as a plural wife, Emily stayed with the prophet, slept with him. When asked where Emma slept that evening, Emily replied in 1892, she was in her room, I suppose. I don't know where she was. And then after that, Emma never let Joseph sleep with them again. So looking at the timeline, and you know the story of July 12th, Hiram says, write down a revelation. I'll take it to Emma. He does so. She rejects it. The next day, they have an agreement. There's property transferred. And I believe that at that time, Emma had threatened to expose him or divorce. And so they have an agreement. This is Clayton's journal again. And I believe part of that agreement was that Joseph would not be sealed to any more plural wives. Joseph was only sealed to two more after that. And if we look at it, in August, Emma's on the warpath, but in September, October, she softens, receives her own endowment so she can give it to others. And Melissa, she marries Melissa Lott. And Melissa said that Emma was aware of that marriage. The other marriage after this was an eternity-only sealing to Brigham Young's sister. And you can read about that, but the context is clear, so she'll just have a husband in the next life. I've attempted to read every known document relating to Joseph Smith's polygamy. I'm sure I've missed some. I'm sure I've forgotten a lot, just Alzheimer's coming in or something. But I hope that nothing truly significant has been missed. I believe that the scary thing about Joseph Smith's polygamy is not Joseph Smith, not his choices and behaviors. The scary thing about Joseph Smith's polygamy is simply polygamy because he lived it and established it among the Latter-day Saints.
Take more time introducing George Smith than to say that I think we owe him a great debt of gratitude for the impetus he's given to Mormon studies. as publisher of Signature Books, as well as a researcher and author. Is all right, George.
Well, I guess if Joseph was gracious in giving these young women an ultimatum to help them decide to marry him, we have to say that Emma was gracious to give Joseph an ultimatum. I'm sure the speaker would agree with that. Joseph Smith's wives, numerous, secret, and many with their own husbands, have perplexed his admirers for over a century. And even today, the LDS Church edits its teaching manuals as if it would like to forget about them. Credits to Brian Hales. He refuses to sweep history under the rug. To the contrary, rather than anesthetize us to the complex and for some perplexing marital history of the Mormon prophet, as he sought to restore all things before the end of the world, the speaker has flung open the door, turned on the lights, and has begun counting. We've begun to see some of the counting up on the screen. Every woman Joseph Smith might have wed, every woman he might have dated, been friendly with, every person who has tabulated Joseph's wives. The total wives vary, of course, quite a bit since the marriages were secret, very secret, and even denied. To underline that point, which is very important, why we're so interested in polygamy is because it was so secret. In the words of the prophet that he spoke at church on May 26, 1844, and we've all heard these, but they're amazing. What a thing it is for a man to be accused of committing adultery and having seven wives when I can only find one. On that day, as we know, Joseph had between 30 and 40 wives, something in that area. Plural wives were so secret in the Mississippi River town of Nauvoo, Illinois, in the 1840s, as Joseph's second plural wife, Zina Jacobs, revealed, it was something too sacred to be talked about. I never breathed it for years. We hardly dared speak of it. The very walls had ears. We spoke of it only in whispers. In an autobiographical account within her diary, she added that the spiritual wives, as we were then termed, were not very numerous in those days, and a spiritual baby was a rarity indeed. Sarah Levitt described the marital system she found in Nauvoo. It was whispered in my ear by a friend that the authorities were getting more wives than one. Whispered, but secret. One of Joseph Smith's bodyguards, John D. Lee, confirmed the code of silence regarding plural wives in Nauvoo. He noted that people had to be kept still lest they reveal anything to an outsider. And this meant a young man did not know when he was talking to a single woman. Brian Hales has collected the work of 24 writers, beginning in 1842 with John C. Bennett, and in the 20th century with Stanley Snow Ivins, who actually resurrected the inquiry into Joseph's numerous but undefined marriages. And then going on with Todd Compton, and in this century, he refers to Lyndon Cook, Richard Bushman, Gary Bergera, Michael Marquardt, Lyle Brown, myself, and concluding with Brian Hales himself. It was really in 1869 that Joseph F. Smith, the prophet's nephew, began to collect affidavits of these many denied marriages and essentially broke the story open. But after government pressure on the LDS Church and the various manifestos, 1890, 1904, some would say 1911, the LDS Church pulled the shades on the Nauvoo marriages, although injunction to marry plural wives remained in Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants. After listing the names of some 64 women who have been mentioned as possible wives of Joseph Smith, excluding posthumous marriages, Brian Hales then goes a step further. He collects statements from persons who have accused Joseph Smith of polygamy and calls these anti-Mormon accusations. I don't think I have enough time to go. What do I have? 2 minutes or?
Four
minutes. I think maybe here the speaker gets into a little bit of trouble, that in two ways. One, calling the accusers anti-Mormons. These people were close friends of Joseph. They were part of his church. Oliver Cowdery certainly accused him of dirty, filthy, nasty, whatever affair with Fanny Alger. But he was Joseph's close friend. He wrote the entire words to the Book of Mormon. He was also Joseph's cousin. Of course, John Bennett was assistant president of the church. Joseph took him into his home, which is one place that he would have had access to seeing him courting women and being aware of the marriages. And he wrote about some of the marriages that were confirmed by other writers. Joseph gave him a revelation. But like Cowdery, they had a spat. Bennett blew Joseph's cover on polygamy and then left. William Law, another close person to Joseph, financed many of his construction projects in Nauvoo, defended him against Bennett when Joseph said he was unjustly accused. But then after convincing Law that he was not taking secret wives in Nauvoo, Joseph betrayed his own denial by issuing a revelation in 1843. Of course, William Law heard about this, asked Hiram, received a copy, went to talk to his wife. He writes, "She and I were just turned upside down by it. We did not know what to do. I think she said we ought to sell our property before things get worse. I said to my wife I would take it over to Joseph and ask him about it. I did not believe he would acknowledge it." And that's what happened in October of 1843. And instead of denying it, Joseph answered him, "Yes, this is a genuine revelation." And then Law brought up the article on marriage in 1835, saying we believe in only one wife. And Joseph then said, "Well, that was time to feed people on milk. Now it is necessary to give them strong meat." And at this juncture, the thing unravels entirely. Law tries to convince Joseph to quit the secret marriages that he's denying. He refuses. There's a lawsuit and a newspaper article, which is destroyed. Joseph is arrested and killed in jail. And then his followers very soon are expelled, sent out of Illinois and of the country. So it ends in a terrible disaster. There's a lot more to talk about. One is this whole list of the people who were accusers of Joseph Smith. I think we could probably look at those. Some of their historians, newspapermen, some friends, close people to Joseph. I think that's something we probably need to talk about. There's really so much that he's brought up. I think it's a very important contribution, Brian, you're making to bring this up. And thank you very much.
Which leaves us 14 minutes for your questions and their answers. If one of you wants to stand here so that you each have a microphone and can answer immediately, that would be fine.
Stand.
Oh, God, I can't be removed.
Two assumptions, correct me if I'm wrong on these assumptions, but there seem to be two assumptions you're making in your comments. One, that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, Two, that God had revealed to Joseph Smith to practice polygamy. Question I have, can you give one good reason why an omniscient God would give such a command and any benefits that would be associated with it?
I presented at the Fair Conference, and I outlined five reasons that the LDS apologists give that Joseph established polygamy. You'll have to go to their website to get that, I guess. But they're on my website, actually. Joseph gave three reasons that polygamy was established. One is that Old Testament plural marriage needed to be restored. And then you quote Acts 3:19, I think it is, of restitution of all things. And this is really all Joseph had to ever say, because there's no theology in the Old Testament explaining marriage. Plural marriage, monogamy, singleness, nothing is there. There's no theology. Joseph didn't have to come up with any theology to explain why we were doing polygamy, because all he had to say was, they did it, I'm a restorer, I'm restoring it. End of discussion. But in fact, he gave us two theological reasons for it. The second one is that there were a lot of premortal spirits that needed to come into believing families. And, unique thing about the LDS religion is we believe we lived before we came here. And so the argument was there were noble and great spirits, and we needed polygamy to allow more of them to come down into believing families. The third one has to do with the doctrine that exaltation occurs to couples. It doesn't occur singly. Individuals who are not sealed to a spouse by proper authority live singly and separately throughout eternity. Without exaltation in their saved condition. That's section 132, 15, 16 or so. And so the minute that God revealed to Joseph, if we believe it happened that way, that exaltation occurred to couples, unless you had exactly equal number of worthy men and women, you're going to need to have some form of polygamy, either polyandry or polygyny, to allow the worthy individuals who were not sealed to be sealed in polygamy to somebody so they can be exalted. I didn't explain that very well, but does that make sense? There's going to be an excess number of worthy men or women, and if exaltation occurs to couples, you're going to have to do something with those worthy men and women, and that means sealing them into them.
I've noticed in the past couple of weeks even, there's been a resurgence online on blogs of interest in the revisionist argument that Joseph Smith fought polygamy. There's sort of been a resurgence of that sort of arguments that he was against polygamy and that there's some kind of conspiracy involved with polygamy. So I wanted to hear what were the, in your estimation, the strongest contemporary primary sources of evidence that Joseph Smith actively practiced polygamy, that it wasn't some kind of big conspiracy of Brigham Young or other apostles putting him into it, but that Joseph Smith was actively involved with it from contemporary sources of Joseph Smith's period. What do you think the strongest evidence is for that?
Did you want to respond to that?
Why don't you lead, Mel?
Okay.
Join in.
There's a group of, I think they're kind of Community of Christ or RLDS fundamentalists, Richard and Pamela Price, and they've done a lot of really good research. And they've published a book, Joseph Smith Fought Polygamy. And there's still a lot of holdouts in the Community of Christ among primarily the members, not the historians in that sector. I just spoke with Mark Shearer, who admits that the scholarly group are understanding what happened, but a lot of the rank and file members are still struggling. There's just no really good evidence. You can quote William Marks, who left two or three big long quotes that Joseph Smith was going to give it up. And then there's a few theories that it was a concoction of Brigham Young and not Joseph Smith. But when you get into the actual evidence, and it's a mountain of evidence, especially when my books come out, you'll see. I mean, there's just no way to cognitive dissonance people talk about, where you see something and just have to say, no, it didn't happen. That's almost the only way you're going to be able to respond that way.
What's the single most important piece of it? I think that's what he's asking in it.
Well, William Marks's accounts would be it, where he said Joseph was going to give it up. To my mind, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that comes after the fact. Of course, William Clayton's journals. But some of those are contemporary, and the conflicts that Joseph had with Emma and those witnessed by William Clayton certainly illustrate something's going on at the time.
Brian, I've been in the singles, LDS singles scene for 11 years now, and there's a thing about different dating personality types that you might want to look at. There are men out there who instead of dating towards building a relationship towards marriage or even having a long-term relationship, they seem to be somewhat addicted to having someone fall in love with them, and then they just, as soon as that person is committed to them and they, I love you or they care for you, they're dating steady, they immediately go on and find another person who does the same thing. And they'll do it again and again. The term is, I mean, it's not flattering, but it's a player. And these players go out and they're addicted to the idea that someone's going to fall in love with them, be committed to them. And this kind of explains to a certain extent that you're not finding a lot of evidence of sexual involvement. And if Joseph Smith were notice this derogatory term, if he were a player and that he's addicted to this idea of people falling in love with him and being committed to him, and he goes from person to person, it could be an explanation for some of the evidence that you're seeing there. And there are people like, there's sometimes people that are players that they want two or three women. If they can get two or three women in love with them at the same time, they are on cloud nine. And then they'll suddenly drop those three women and find three more that will be falling in love and be committed to them. So I don't know if you are familiar with that kind of a concept and how does that, what do you think of that idea anyway?
You want to start now?
Well, this is a question you really want to ask Emma. Good source. I don't think we could affirm or deny, frankly, but it's a good question.
Bill Moran makes that argument in his book on Joseph Smith. He suggests that in his cycle biographical book. The one about the Sword of Laban.
Oh, the Sword of Laban,
yeah,
Bill Moran, yes.
He makes that argument that Joseph Smith was incapable of establishing a long-lasting relationship because of the traumas that he suffered in his youth, particularly the leg operation. That's kind of a psychological explanation.
Well, didn't Signature do, is it Robert Anderson?
Yes.
Robert Anderson makes a similar
argument. Yeah, yeah, and Signature published that.
It's a little bit different argument.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well,
the only thing I would say is when that happens, the women get ticked off at the guy, and we don't find any of the 34 wives giving any negative report on Joseph. Only one of them denied being married to him later. It was Sarah Lawrence. And the others, of course, a lot of them died younger. They didn't give us any accounts. But you go through all of the accounts, and they all respected Joseph. They spoke of him with respect and with love, considered themselves an actual wife. I mean, there were political reasons for them to want to do that. I admit that. But still, if he had abused them in any way, as a player might, you'd think somebody would complain.
Well, I think you have to also consider what little time Joseph would have had with any of these 30 to 40 wives. And I just had something written down about Melissa Lott, which I could kind of quote. They were asking her, why don't you have children by Joseph? Were you intimate with him? She said, yes, we were intimate. I was like a wife to him. And she said, I'm not sure why we didn't have children. Maybe the conditions weren't right. Maybe it's my fault, woman stuff. It's beyond the scope of this discussion. But then she said he was being constantly chased and by sheriffs, and it was very hard for him to have quiet, relaxed time. And he didn't have a hearth with 30 plus women. He had a home with Emma, and he visited, perhaps. I don't know how he maintained his marital relationships with these women, but he didn't apparently have a lot of domestic tranquility that he would share, and therefore have a relationship that could develop that, where he would be close and then leave, like the player argument presumes.
Brian, you mentioned that Sarah Pratt was engaged, that the research you found suggested that she was engaged in a sexual relationship with John Bennett. What's your basis for that, and did George, your research also come to that same conclusion?
You have two stories that come out of that. I have a whole chapter on it in my book. Story number one is that Joseph Smith made illicit advances to Sarah Pratt, did something against her virtue or something. It wasn't physical, but And that was the witnesses for that are Sarah Pratt and John Bennett. And that's really all that they're giving that story. But it's well advanced, and even historians have picked up on it as the primary. The other story that you have coming from Joseph Smith is that Sarah and John were sexually involved with one another. And you've got affidavits from a number of individuals who say they ran into them when they're in a compromised position and others. Richard Van Wagner has discounted these in his book. But if you look closely at it, the arguments are problematic. If you go to the actual affidavits, you know, to excuse them as some have done, I don't think it's good scholarship. And the evidence is real strong. These two were sleeping together, and then they tried to cover it up. That's what I think is the stronger of the evidence of the.
Did your research also find that, George?
I didn't find anything definitive suggesting that. I know this was a time when there was a lot of concern about missionaries and wives at home. And I guess Orson Hyde's wife, he was away, and apparently Joseph, at a couple of points, one said something like, you know, follow what you're told, and that was in the winter, and then there was a note added to one of the records that in that following April that they had been married. But that's not a lot of literature. It's just, you know, a couple of notes. I suppose it's possible. Some of these sound like defenses. Like Bennett is an attacker. Joseph is defending his reputation. Somebody attacks Joseph, so it's like a turnabout. I think that needs a lot of examination.
Hey, thank you, Bill.
Yeah.
We have a minute and a half left.
This will be short. Your books sound absolutely fascinating. I just wondered if you knew where they might be for sale, especially during the symposium.
That was Kurt Bench, and you know how great Colbert is. We're working on it.
He's always asking those pesky questions.
I was just thinking about the quote from Brigham Young about how polygamy worked, and if all men had a lot of wives, and said that some had just one wife, others didn't. But I was under the impression that it was like somewhat of a calling, like men, like elders form presidents, or like certain men were called to practice polygamy and others weren't. Or is that not? I was wondering if that was it more of a calling, or was it more of like it was open to anybody who was.
Well, initially, Joseph invited, I counted about 32 people, men that he knew, and he said, it's very important that you do this. The first one was Brigham Young, that we're aware of. He just gotten home from mission, and Joseph said, I know you're reuniting with your wife, and actually he was producing a homecoming child. It was a very awkward time, but he insisted Brigham Young seek a plural wife. And I guess Heber Kimball was close after. And this is very awkward because this is the time Bennett was just coming to make announcements. Well, I guess this is in 42. And so Joseph went to Brigham and to Heber while Bennett was publishing his information about polygamy, revealing it. And Brigham and Heber had to go on a mission in southern Illinois and say, there's no polygamy. Bennett is lying, and they had just themselves taken plural wives, and Joseph had stopped marrying for about 6 months. So there was a hiatus of 6 months, and then it began again in the early part of 1843. So there was a lot of tension, and Bennett certainly had an effect. Whether he's a good guy or a bad guy, he had an enormous influence on Joseph and people's views of polygamy, and the whole newspaper from Illinois to the New York Herald. That's how Mormons got known, for polygamy and coffee. Those are the two things. Sure.
We'll allow one last question.
Thank you. This is to Brian. You said there was no coercion. Would you comment on the report in George's book about Joseph helping Brigham, trying to coerce a young girl to, I can't remember her name.
Brotherton.
Was that not coercion, at least for somebody else? The second thing is in the 132nd section. There is some coercion of Emma. In fact, she's said you'll be condemned if you don't accept and allow Joseph to have a wife. Was this Joseph talking, or was this the benevolent Lord Jesus Christ threatening Emma?
I've always said we don't judge Emma. She had the hardest road to hoe, and 132 would be very hard, even for the most faithful Latter-day Saint, to understand if you were Emma and in her shoes. You know, the threat was that she'd be destroyed, and that sounds very harsh, but essentially the interpretation is that if you don't make it to the celestial kingdom, then you're destroyed as far as the blessings that are there. That's the interpretation that I think is really accurate. And the first part of your question was, Martha Brotherton, fascinating account. I think most of what Bennett wrote was not accurate, but the affidavits, some of them are very useful. And this one is, and I quote a lot of it. You could say that there was some coercion, but it didn't work. I mean, you know, he didn't marry her. It wasn't successful, but they taught her, and she was resistant, and so he brings Joseph in, and they try to talk her into it, and it doesn't work, and then she leaves. Is that coercion? I mean, I guess if you want to define it as such, sure.
So you're saying if the person doesn't cave, it's not coercion?
What? If they don't cave, it's not coercion? Well, if you invite them, is that coercion? I don't know. I guess we're haggling over words here. So I don't think it's a big deal. But you can read the account. It's real fascinating.
Where I'm more skeptical, I might consider the sound of that revelation threatening Emma with personal destruction as having the sound of Joseph's voice. Were I more skeptical?